This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sandra Postel, director of the Global Water Policy Project and co-creator of Change the Course, the National Water Stewardship Initiative awarded the 2017 U.S. Water Prize for restoring billions of gallons of water to depleted rivers and wetlands. From 2009 to 2015, Sandra served as Freshwater Fellow of the National Geographic Society and is the author of Pillar of Sand, Can the Irrigation Miracle Last? And Last Oasis, Facing Water Scarcity. Sandra Postel is here to tell us about her most recent book, Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity, published in 2017. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is your purpose in writing your book, Replenish?
My purpose in writing Replenish was to really inform everyone that there are so many ways we can build water security for the future that's coming in ways that benefit nature as well as our communities and our economy. And to make the point that sort of the old way we did things with water, which was largely controlling nature to control water, is not going to serve us as well in the future as it has in the past. And I'm talking about things like dams to store water, levees to control floods, big reservoirs to manage floods and store water for irrigation and water supply, that while we're still going to need good engineering, and some of those will still, you know, be top of mind, we really need to get more creative about how we prepare for droughts and floods and wildfires and water shortages. And that working with nature rather than against it is going to more often than not be more cost effective and a better solution overall.
Would you say more about what you mean by working with nature rather than against nature?
Let's maybe take an example of flooding, which is, you know, very much on our minds right now after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, and of course, not very many years ago, the big flood along the Mississippi River in 2011, the biggest we'd seen in a long time. And then one of the points I make in Replenish is that floodplains, that is the land right alongside rivers, historically have done a very good job of capturing that flood water and cleansing that water as it seeps through the wetlands alongside the river, along the floodplain, and then storing that water, recharging groundwater, and then providing that water more gradually back to the river. So it has a water quality, a water supply function, as well as providing incredible habitat, right, for birds and wildlife and fish. The way we've gone about flood control, if you will, in the 20th century is largely to levee, you know, build dikes and levees alongside rivers, which if you think about the hydraulics of that, you're basically, when a flood comes down, you're constraining the river, which then causes it to rise and flow faster. And so in a sense, you're making the potential for damages downstream, if there's a breach of those levees, potentially more dangerous and more hazardous. And we've seen exactly this happen. On the Mississippi River, for example, in 2011, the Army Corps of Engineers faced a big decision whether to breach a levee in order to save the town of Cairo, Illinois. Well, they ended up breaching that levee, and it was a dedicated floodway that the river was able to exit and empty onto some farmland, and showed that if, in fact, you know, you provided a way for the river to access that floodplain, you could reduce those damages. But we've done this very selectively. We haven't done it in a strategic way. And so, again, reconnecting the river to the floodplain, letting rivers be rivers again, if you will, is increasingly going to be important as we have more intense flooding and more flooding. And as we've built on these floodplains, allowing the river to reclaim some of that land. And we've seen the beginnings of this in the United States, as I say, along the Mississippi, where we've dedicated a few floodways, but could do much, much more to allow the river to use its own floodplain. And again, we'd have multiple benefits from that. We would have more water storage in that floodplain, cleaner water as a result of the wetlands doing what they do naturally, which is to remove those pollutants, and then more protection downstream. So you'd have less of that incredible intense runoff heading down toward, in this case, Louisiana. The other big set of benefits would be for the dead zone in the Gulf that we hear about almost every summer, where you have a lot of nitrogen running off of our cropland in the heartland of this country, which is heading into streams and rivers, and again, heading down through the vast Mississippi watershed toward the Gulf of Mexico, and then creating this big algal bloom, which then can deplete oxygen from those coastal waters. So this simple act of, I shouldn't say simple, because it would require some concerted effort to find the best areas for this to happen, to engage landowners and compensating them adequately for using what is now private land in some cases as floodways. But the benefits to the nation as a whole in this case could be substantial. And so I think in this way, again, it's working with nature. We have the need for engineering, absolutely, but let's bring nature back into the equation. We've lost a lot of benefit from disconnecting rivers from their floodplains and their wetlands. We've lost those water quality benefits. We've lost those habitat benefits. We've lost a lot of those important services, if you will, that floodplains can provide. So let's get smart about how we control floods in the future, and they're going to be getting worse, and bring nature back into the solution.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sandra Postel, director of the Global Water Policy Project and author of the book Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Would you give an overview of the ways we have broken nature's water cycle and the corresponding consequences?
Well, there are so many. And what I do in Replenish is really try to look at this in a somewhat systematic way. You know, if you think about the water cycle, it is the most important asset that planet Earth has. It gives us the gift of life. And yet we take so much of the water cycle for granted. And we're talking about how water moves from the atmosphere to the land, across the landscape, including underground, of course, and then flows back to the sea. It's this cycle of movement in all its forms, as a solid, liquid, and gas, as ice, as liquid water, and as vapor, and how it moves. And we've broken this cycle in very important ways. So let's take a few examples. One is, let's just think about dams and how rivers flow naturally back to the sea. Well, we've built around the world now more than 50,000 large dams, and these are dams that are 49 feet or higher. So that's a lot of interruption of that natural flow. So we have many of the world's major rivers now operating almost more like plumbing systems than as natural river systems. We turn them on and off like faucets, if you will. And so that's disrupted the natural flow regime of these rivers. And all of the life in these rivers has adapted to that natural flow regime. For example, a big flood in the spring will motivate fish and cue fish to go and spawn. If they don't get that flood signal, they may not spawn. Dams, of course, block fish from moving upstream. They can't get to their spawning grounds. So in a number of ways, dams are a good example of how we've broken that cycle of the natural flow of water. And we have now in this country removed nearly 1,200 dams, mostly small ones. This is just over the last 30 years, mostly small ones, but also some big ones, including right there in the state of Washington on the Elwha River, the Glynis Canyon Dam and the Elwha Dam, which came down between, I believe, 2011 and 2014. And the fish populations in the Elwha River are now bigger than they've been in 30 years. So the fish will bounce back when given a chance to have that natural flow regime back in a river system. We've also, of course, broken the water cycle in how we farm our land. I devote a whole chapter to talking about the soil reservoir. And this was a surprise to me, in fact, that the amount of water stored in the soil is 8 times greater than water that's flowing in all of the world's rivers combined. So it is an enormous reservoir. This is an important part of that water cycle, and it's the water that grows our crops, that supplies all of our grasslands and our forests. The soil reservoir is incredibly important. And so what we're seeing now is that because of the ways we grow crops, and raise cattle, that the soil reservoir has been diminished. We've taken, you know, the organic matter out of the soil, it's eroded away, and so we're not using that reservoir effectively. And so I devote a whole chapter to how more innovative farmers are using better techniques of raising crops, including cover cropping and other measures that can build resilience against drought and improve that soil reservoir. And they're seeing higher yields and lower costs, reduced need for fertilizer, all kinds of multiple benefits from paying attention to that soil reservoir. So just increasing soil health can improve the amount of water that can be stored in that soil, which farmers find to be an incredibly important measure to take as resilience against drought. Just as one concrete example, researchers have found that if you can raise the organic carbon level in soils by just one percentage point, let's say going from 3% to 4% carbon in the soil, that allows you to store an extra 18,000 gallons of water an acre. That's going to vary by the type of soil, but you get the idea that we can expand that reservoir by building in soil health. So those are two examples. A third very important one is how we've broken the water cycle in the depletion of groundwater. This for a long time was an out of sight, out of mind problem. I took a stab at estimating groundwater depletion back in the late 90s and using the best data available that I could. And it was not a bad estimate. It was pretty much in the ballpark. But we have much better data now thanks to satellites that are able to measure water storage in the soil by using gravity measurements. We have a NASA mission called GRACE, which stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, which essentially allows scientists to estimate changes in water storage under the ground. And so we have a sense now that in parts of China, in parts of India, Pakistan, the Western United States, these are four of the major food producing regions of the world, we've lost a lot of groundwater. And we saw during the California drought and during the 14 or 15 year drought in the Colorado River Basin, that what farmers did when the surface water supplies diminished, when the reservoirs were shrinking, they went underground and pumped more groundwater. And so we've been losing that important water storage. And groundwater is a critical supply during drought. It's the water you want to be able to go to in an emergency situation like a drought. But we've been overusing it in a very chronic way on a sustained basis. And so that depletion very much poses a risk to future food security. About 10% of our food supply now depends on the overpumping of groundwater. And so that's a bubble in the food economy that can't be sustained. It will pop at some point, and we'll see an effect in the way of rising food prices, potential more food shortages, and this kind of thing. So it's a out of sight, out of mind problem that we really need to attend to. And one of the examples I provide in Replenish is the attempt in California's Central Valley, which has undergone very rapid depletion of groundwater, especially during that five-year drought in California that we just went through, that scientists and conservationists and farmers in the Central Valley are now working together to use wintertime snowmelt and flood water to actively recharge the groundwater beneath those farmers' fields. And so, for example, I visited an almond grower in the Central Valley that had dedicated several acres, I think 5 acres of his almond grove, to this experiment where winter flood water would flood his field. These are flooding, you know, the almond trees during that wintertime or dormant season, and allow that water to literally soak through the soil and recharge the groundwater below. Now, it's a little risky because what's going to happen to the roots of the almond tree? What's going to happen to the water quality as you have water seeping down through farmland into the groundwater? So scientists are measuring these effects, and so far they're finding that it seems to be not only feasible, but a good thing, that the recharge is happening. There's not a big risk to the plants and the trees as they've studied it so far, and they're measuring the effects on water quality. So this is an active way of replenishing that groundwater supply that's been depleted, and it is cheaper than building a new dam. If you look at the cost of a dam that's been proposed in the Central Valley on the San Joaquin River, comparing that with these recharge efforts, it's less than 14% of the cost to do it in this way versus building the dam. So again, cost-effective, a way of repairing the water cycle and building water security for the future.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sandra Postel, director of the Global Water Policy Project and author of the book Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you speak about a number of rivers that have begun to run dry because of human use. Would you mention those and then also talk about some of the steps that are being taken to try to restore the flow of the rivers?
This is something that surprised me. I've been working on water issues for 30 years at this point. And when I first started looking, I guess, about 20 years ago, at some of the major rivers around the world, I had just returned from Central Asia looking at the problem of the Aral Sea, which at that time was the world's fourth largest lake. It's an inland sea in Central Asia. And part of the reason it was drying up was because the rivers flowing into it had been so heavily diverted that they were no longer replenishing the Aral Sea. They were instead growing cotton in the desert. And I began, when I got back from that trip, looking more worldwide at what was going on with rivers and was surprised to find, again, the internet age was barely on us yet. So a lot of this was data that you had to sort of dig for, and it's much more available now. But gosh, the Nile, the Ganges, the Colorado here in North America, the Rio Grande here in North America, the Amudarya, that's one of the rivers in Central Asia, and the Yellow River, the mother river of China. All of them running dry for periods of time, sometimes most of the time in the case of a river like the Colorado, and not reaching their final destination. These should be perennial rivers, right? And they have a cycle of floods and droughts like anywhere, but should be perennial rivers. And yet they were routinely running dry for some period of time in the year or across many years before reaching the sea. And so this meant that that important part of the water cycle, rivers delivering nutrients and sediment to their deltas and to the coastal zones, was no longer happening. And many of these deltas are some of the most productive and important ecosystems on the planet. The Nile Delta, for example, not only important for farmland, but also very important ecologically. And as a result of dams trapping the sediment that a river should naturally be carrying to the coastal zones, it means that sea level rise is that much worse because the sediment is no longer there to keep building up the delta. And so you have sea level rise on top of this lack of replenishment of the delta, meaning that some of these areas are going to be underwater much sooner than they otherwise would be because of that combination. So you look at the Colorado River Delta, the Nile Delta, the Delta of the Yellow River in China. And these are significant rivers, right, that supply hundreds of millions of people with drinking water and are very important to farmers and very important to fisheries. And these rivers are no longer reaching the sea. And so this is, again, an important example of breaking that water cycle. And I've spent some time the last few years playing a small part. Other conservationists have been working on this very, very hard, thinking about how can we restore and replenish to some degree the Colorado River Delta. And that's been a big emphasis in recent years, thanks to a minute that was passed by the U.S. and Mexico in 2012, which did a number of things to rethink management of the Colorado River, but included a provision to try an experiment that would send a small amount of water back through the Delta and out to the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California, and then some active rehabilitation and restoration of habitats in the Colorado River Delta to see what would happen if we made a concerted effort to put some water back in that system. Remember, the Colorado has been running dry in most years for nearly 90 miles before it reaches the sea. Close to the U.S.-Mexico border, there's a dam where Mexico takes its 10% share of the Colorado River. And between the 90% share that we're completely using in the United States and the 10% share that Mexico uses, there's nothing left for the river. And so that last 90 miles of the Delta has, in most years, been completely dry. So So the delta, which used to be a 2 million acre, beautifully lush, incredible wetland for birds on the Pacific Flyway, for all kinds of wildlife, has been dried out. It's completely desiccated, with the exception of a few areas. But thanks to this conservation effort by conservationists on both sides of the border, there's been an effort to build some stepping stones of habitat again in the delta and begin to restore areas that birds and wildlife can again use. And it's been an interesting and great learning experiment for scientists, but also an indication that, you know, we can make a difference. We can make a conscious effort to try to repair some of the damage that our previous approach to water management has done. And I think that's an important lesson, that if we choose to add water back to some of these systems, we can recreate some important habitat and regain some of what was lost.
Would you give an additional example of a collaborative effort to share water?
Oh, there are so many. And it's one of the things I enjoyed most about writing this book were these interesting collaborations between farmers and ranchers and conservationists and government agencies and local communities. It's just very inspiring to me when I looked out at these examples and how many there are. And I think that's maybe the most inspiring aspect, at least for me, of researching and writing this book. So one of the ones I've participated in our Change the Course program that I really love is what's been going on in the Verde River in Arizona. This is a beautiful desert river. The Verde is a tributary to the Colorado River, and it starts in the Flagstaff-Sedona area, so north-central Arizona, and then it flows south toward Phoenix and then eventually hits the Colorado River itself. But what's happened is, as many rivers, the Verde became a very important supply of irrigation water to farmers in the Verde Valley. And pretty much farmers have been doing what they've done for the last 150 years, which is during the irrigation season, taking pretty much all of the water out of the Verde River and putting it into their irrigation ditch system. And then they deliver water to farmers and other irrigators. And then the water will eventually, some of it, whatever's not used by the plants, flow back, but sometimes miles and miles downstream. So you'll end up in that irrigation system with about 5, 6, 7, 8 miles of the Verde River being completely depleted. So no water at all, or very, very small amount for months at a time during that irrigation season. Obviously, that's not good for fish, not good for birds. And I should mention that the Verde is one of those desert rivers in the southwestern U.S. that is a lifeline for birds and wildlife, especially birds. The habitat along the river, obviously birds and wildlife need water, and in the southwest there's very little of it. And so these desert rivers are extremely important for birds and wildlife, and the Verde is a paradise of bird life. And so conservationists, particularly the Nature Conservancy in this case, with a very innovative hydrologist named Kim Schoenick, who arrived from Oregon and working for the Nature Conservancy, and began to talk to the irrigators and look at their needs for water and what could be done, and discovered that with some innovative technologies that had been tried elsewhere but applied to the Verde, including, for example, these automated head gates, solar-powered automated head gates that allowed irrigators to measure the amount of water they took and to leave the rest for the river. So in other words, with this automation, they could be confident of taking out of the river what they needed, but not taking an excess. So it allowed the river to keep some water even as the irrigators got what they needed. And so for the Verde Valley as a community, this was a win-win-win, right? Because the irrigators got what they needed. The river had water in it throughout the summer. So you have water for rafting and boating and recreation. The birds got better habitat as a result. So you have an asset now in the Verde Valley in the form of a healthier river system, better habitat, and also a smarter irrigation system and irrigators getting the water they need. So it increases the value of water to everyone in that valley. And it was a simple solution, these automated head gates. But it took a partnership of the irrigators, the conservation community, and funders. In this case, you know, Change the Course helped in our small way by bringing in some corporate sponsorships from companies that were eager to balance their water footprint by giving some water back to nature, which is what our program Change the Course is all about. It's motivating people to do what they can to conserve and then go beyond that and give some water back to nature. And we provide that link to those companies that are interested in doing that but need help finding a project to do it. And we help to link those companies up with, for example, the Verde Valley. And so this is a great example of how it takes a partnership, in many cases, I would say, to achieve these ends. And working together, it shows what can be accomplished. When you have irrigators or farmers that are open and interested, you have the conservation community listening and paying attention and looking at what potential solutions would work for everyone, and then bringing in some funding to make it happen. And so this was, for us, a very rewarding project, and we were able to just play a small role in making this happen. But it shows what can be done when you have those collaborative partnerships come together.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message I would want to leave listeners with is, you know, really one of realistic optimism. It's so easy, and I struggle with this, it's so easy to get despairing today about our state of the environment. It's despairing to see these rivers running dry. It's despairing to see all the problems that we have with not only our water cycle, but of course with our ability to deal with climate issues. So it's easy to fall into a state of despair. But I think what I learned in researching and writing this book is that we can make a difference. We can make a difference at the community level, at the state level, in our watershed, in our river system, and that one wetland, one river, one aquifer at a time, we can make a difference. It might feel like one step forward, two steps back, but frankly, that one step forward can make a difference for those fish, for those birds, for that wetland. And we're going to build water security gradually in this way. And it's pioneering some new ideas. We need to be innovative here in how do we bring our traditional engineering solutions together with these more ecologically minded solutions that I think are going to be so necessary to building water security. So there's a lot of innovation and a lot of excitement, I think, ahead in terms of how we improve this water cycle. How do we build water security in a way that's going to prepare us for more floods and more droughts and more wildfire and more water shortages? So it's an exciting time. And so I think it's that inspiration I hope to leave everyone with, and that we can all play a role. We're all part of this water cycle, and how we use water every day, how we manage our homes and landscapes every day, our own personal water footprint, thinking about that, we can all make a difference. And especially, I think, getting involved in our local water issues is critically important.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sandra.
Thank you, Diane.
You were just listening to Sandra Postel, director of the Global Water Policy Project and author of the book Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity, published in 2017 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at globalwaterpolicy.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.